Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa.
Good afternoon. I think everybody probably has those handouts that we've been using over the past few weeks. I promise today will be the last day that we will be using this handout. Okay, we have been studying the Mangala Sutta from the Sutta Nipata. And as I've explained several times, this sutta lays out the kind of plan or program which sketches very, very concisely the ideal life, the ideal way of life, covering all aspects of life from what we call the very starting point of leading a proper, upright, successful life, taking one through one's preparation by way of education and training, then into family life, fulfilling one's social and civil responsibilities. Then it leads one into personal ethics, then into a spiritual life. So we've been going through this sutta verse by verse. And today we come to the last verses. And so, taking our textbook, the translation, the Sutta Nipata, we are now on verse number 10, which I will recite first in Pali, then read the translation, then explain.
Tapo cha brahmacharyam cha arya-satchana-dasanam nibbana-satcha-kiriyaccha etam mangalam-uttamam.
According to the translation we have here, which I'm not completely satisfied with. Self-control, perception of the noble truths, and the realization of Nibbana. This is the most auspicious performance. I would translate rather austerity, vision or seeing of the noble truths, and the realization of Nibbana. This is the most auspicious performance. Okay, before I explain this verse itself, I backtrack a little bit. And I explained earlier that with verse number 7, according to my ground plan scheme, it's also verse number 7 according to the book's numbering, that marks what I call the entryway, the entrance to the world-transcending path. One has now entered upon the training, the discipline, aimed at the realization of nirvana, the ultimate state of liberation. And one begins that with personal ethics, which is dealt with in verse 7, then verses 8 and 9 are concerned with developing and cultivating the inner virtues that are essential to practicing the world-transcending path. Now, to to understand these verses of the Sutta Nipata, I'd like to use a scheme, kind of analytical scheme, which comes from another Buddha school, the Savastivada school. This might be a little bit complicated, but it's not as complicated as it seems, which divides the stages of spiritual progress according to, I call them, five planes. The term that's used in Sanskrit is actually marga, which means path, and it's translated into Chinese as Tao. So we have the plane of accumulation. That is the stage when one is accumulating the virtuous qualities that are necessary for practicing the path to liberation. In ordinary discourse, we say this is when one is cultivating paramitas, developing pure virtuous qualities. And verses 7, 8, and 9, the way I would understand the sutta, are concerned or fall within the scope of the plane of accumulation. Here one is developing first ethics, avoiding evil, being diligent in wholesome practices. One is cultivating the virtues of reverence, humility, contentment, gratitude, patience, accept the ability to accept advice. And one is also acquainting oneself with the Dharma by listening to discourses on the Dharma, holding discussions on the Dharma, meeting with monks so that one could get some exposure to the qualities of those who are practicing earnestly. And of course, in one's day-to-day life, one will also be practicing to the best of one's ability, meditation, developing from time to time, maybe intensive meditation. But now, the second plane of development is called the plane of exertion. This is where one makes a really strong, earnest, deep commitment to the practice, the intensive practice of the Dhamma, with the aim of reaching realization, reaching insight, reaching higher wisdom. And as I understand it, verse 10 marks a transition from the plane of accumulation, the sambhara marga, to the plane of exertion, the prayoga marga. Jia Xing Tao. And the first quality mentioned here in this, what I call the ascent towards realization, practicing intensely the world-transcending Dhamma, the first quality mentioned here is austerity. The Pali word is tapa, also corresponding to the Sanskrit word tapas. The original meaning of this word, it goes back long before the time of Buddha. The word is related to, it has the meaning of to burn intensely. And the word came to be applied to practices that were undertaken by ascetics and yogis, which involved afflicting hardship and pain upon the body. So that ascetics, those who live very austere, difficult lives, were called tapasas. practitioners of austerity. And some of these ascetic practices included going on fasts for long periods, or confining one's intake of food to certain very simple foods, maybe just eating only fallen fruits, fruits that one finds fallen on the ground, eating only roots, like yams, exposing the body during the hot season, exposing it to the heat of the sun, during the cold season, going about naked or almost naked, sleeping on beds of thorns, standing for long periods without lying down, undertaking all sorts of practices that involve self-deprivation, inflicting hardships on the body. Now, when Westerners look upon these practices coming from people coming from a Christian background, they think that those who are engaged in these practices are doing so because they are punishing themselves. This is a way of tormenting oneself because one has a sense of guilt, a feeling of guilt, and one is trying to exonerate oneself from that sense of guilt through inflicting pain on the body. But that is not the meaning at all within the Indian context. Rather, the belief had developed in India going back probably long before the time of the Buddha, that by depriving oneself of basic enjoyments and inflicting hardship upon the body, one turns the basic energy of the life force inwards, and one builds up within oneself, within the mind, a spiritual power which increases in intensity, increases in force, until it becomes so strong that it reaches what we might call supernatural dimensions. And when one acquires, or when one builds up that spiritual power to this extraordinary extent, one is able to utilize that spiritual power to command the forces of nature to follow one's will. One could even use the power that builds up to command the deities, so that the yogis who build up the force of tapas are able, they are more powerful than the deities, the devas. And even the devas have to follow the command, the will of these powerful yogis, these ascetics. This was the belief in ancient India, not merely a belief, but this was confirmed time and again through practice. The principle is that by going against, in a sense, it's like going against the grain, one, it's like an object going against the force of the wind. One is going against the force of the wind by moving in that direction. It exercises, it accumulates a kind of force of friction, and so that object becomes heated, becomes hot, starts to glow and to radiate. Along the same, analogously, the yogi, by going against the natural inclinations, against the natural dispositions of the mind, builds up the inner force, the heat, the strength of tapas, and is able to use that strength, that force of tapas, to control and command nature, to control and command the deities, even to gain mastery over the forces of life and death, to gain access to immortality. Okay, when the Buddha appeared on the scene, the yogis were also practicing, were still practicing austerity. But the Buddha also undertook the practice of austerities in this way, because he was trying out these methods in the belief that perhaps these methods led to liberation. And so the Buddha undertook these austerities. He said he carried them to an extent that nobody previously had ever carried them. And he said that even though he took them to that extent, he found that they do not lead to liberation. They just torment the body, they weaken the body, but they do not bring wisdom. Maybe some yogis get extraordinary powers through them, but the Buddha wasn't seeking power, he was seeking wisdom and insight. And he found that these techniques don't lead to wisdom. And so he rejected these techniques in order to develop what he called the middle way, the Noble Eightfold Path. But the Buddha didn't reject the concept of tapas, of austerity, but rather he took that word the way he took so many other words from the Brahminic vocabulary. He took the word and incorporated it into his teaching, but gave it a new meaning. Tapas still means austerity, but it is not austerity in the sense of tormenting or afflicting the body. But rather, tapas now means practices that counteract and burn up the defilements. So what are these practices that counteract and burn up the defilements? The practices that burn up the defilements, we could incorporate them into the three headings of Sila, Samadhi, and Panya. That is morality, moral discipline, concentration, and wisdom. But here now, when moral discipline becomes tapas, becomes austerity, it's no longer moral discipline simply as an ethical practice, simply as a moral practice. But we are now going beyond the ethical practices of sila, of moral discipline. And now moral discipline is becoming a way to counteract the defilements in the mind. And this is done by expanding the five precepts for a lay follower on certain occasions into eight precepts. When on these certain days, like the Uposatha days, the full moon and new moon days, in Buddhist countries, lay people take not the five precepts, but the eight precepts. In the five precepts, the third precept becomes celibacy for at least one day a night. But I'll deal with celibacy separately in a few moments. But then, beyond the fifth precept, one has the precept to abstain from taking food after midday. There's nothing immoral about taking food after midday, but one is now cutting out one means of enjoyment, one means of indulgence, for the purpose of reducing the fetter, the bond of self-enjoyment, of enjoyment, of greed. One takes the precept to abstain from singing, dancing, listening to music, enjoying oneself with shows. And coupled with that is the precept to avoid ornamentation or use of cosmetics. Again, this is a way of restraint, of cutting out the tendency of the senses to find, to seek enjoyment. Then one takes the precept to avoid the use of high and luxurious beds and seats. This is a kind of austere practice. Again, the purpose is to promote simplicity, to promote contentment. Okay, beyond these eight precepts, we have further sets of precepts for monastics. And many of these precepts are intended to promote these virtues of simplicity and contentment, counteracting the tendency of the mind to seek indulgence, to seek enjoyment. And again, we are burning up the defilements of greed, the desire for enjoyment. Then the practice of concentration or samadhi is also a type of austerity. Because now one is cutting out the tendency of the mind to wander, to roam, to find enjoyment, to find entertainment amidst the multitude of distracting thoughts. But one is drawing the mind inward, placing the mind upon a single object. And at times the mind becomes very dry in the practice of samadhi. When samadhi is actually reached, it's very cool, very pleasant, very blissful. But in that preliminary stage, one often has to go through very, very dreary periods where one is intensely focusing to burn up defilements. That is the practice of austerity. And then, as one is developing panya or wisdom, this in a way becomes tapas in the very, very strong sense in Buddhism. Because tapas means burning. And it is when one is developing insight that the mind really starts to blaze and burn with an intense flame. It's not an unpleasant flame, but it's a very blissful, pleasant, burning sensation. As insight starts to flow, it's like the mind becomes on fire with insight after insight, going into different layers of impermanence as one is observing the arising and passing away of phenomena. And there comes the sensation as one sits and observes the arising of phenomena, the sense of this very, very strong, it's a very strong, quiet, intense flame burning, 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 burning away these layers, coarse layers of greed, aversion, delusion in the mind. And then when one reaches the breakthrough to the supramundane path, that's when the austerity reaches its climax. The burning and blazing of austerity explodes into the atomic bomb, you could say, the thermonuclear reaction of realization and destroys, obliterates defilements so that they can't arise again. Okay, so this is austerity. And the most important factor in austerity is energy or effort. That's because energy or effort is what drives one forward in this effort to eliminate the defilements and to bring into being the positive, wholesome factors of the path. Okay, after austerity comes the next quality is called brahmacharya. The word brahmacharya literally means the conduct of Brahma. Brahma is the divine. The deities were dwelling in the divine world. And it was the belief in ancient India that those deities dwelling in the divine world were originally human beings like ourselves, and they became deities in the divine world by the observance of celibacy. And so celibacy came to be considered the divine practice, the practice that leads to the divine world. We usually think, being human beings, we think this human realm, the world that we can see with our senses, this is the whole sphere of existence. Whatever exists must be accessible to our senses. But actually, according to the Buddhist way of looking at the universe, our life, everything we could see with our senses, even with our telescopes, with our super powerful microscopes, everything in the sensory domain is like a ping pong ball. And this ping pong ball is inside a tennis ball. The tennis ball is inside a soccer ball or basketball. Okay, the ping pong ball is what we call the sensory realm of existence. So even everything occurring in world systems 15 billion light years away from ourselves is still occurring on the surface of the ping pong ball. Everything occurring that one might see with electronic microscopes is still occurring on the surface of the ping pong ball. But beyond the surface of the ping pong ball, even the worlds of the gods, the lower deities, the devas, that we can't normally see, is still a very thin layer beyond the surface of the ping pong ball. But even totally beyond the ping pong ball, there is the tennis ball, but we have no idea that the tennis ball exists, but we're encompassed by the tennis ball. The tennis ball is the Brahma realm, the Brahma world, the worlds of subtle forms, subtle matter. And beyond the tennis ball are the formless realms. I say that they're like a basketball, but the basketball has form. The formless realms don't have any form at all. How does one get from the ping pong ball to the tennis ball? NASA will never be able to get there. Not through rocket ships, not through spaceships, not through super scientific means, but by cultivating the mind to the level of the jhanas. When the mind is brought to the jhanas, then it can switch over and come to the tennis ball. And when death takes place, if one has mastered the jhanas, then one will be reborn in the Brahma realm. One will take a rebirth, metaphorically, in the surface, on the domain of the tennis ball. Okay, the basic condition for developing the jhanas is the moral condition is the observance of celibacy. And so the practice of celibacy then becomes the brahmacharya, the course of conduct that leads to, at least serves as the condition for developing the jhanas, the meditative absorptions that are the direct path to rebirth in the Brahma realm. And to go beyond the Brahma realm to the formless realms, then one has to develop the concentration beyond the jhanas to the formless attainments. Beyond the formless attainments, or rather in a completely different dimension, is nirvana. And that's not reached simply by going higher and higher, but by piercing through the whole illusory structure of one ball inside another ball inside another ball. That requires wisdom, not deeper and deeper concentration. Okay, so Buddhism teaches that those who want to go take rebirth in the Brahma world, and those who are seeking the most direct path to liberation should undertake the practice of celibacy. The Buddha doesn't make this a binding commitment for all his followers, of course. For lay people, the requirement is to abstain from sexual misconduct. But if one wishes to go directly, as rapidly as possible, towards the extinction of suffering, towards liberation, then the observance of celibacy becomes a strong supporting condition. And for monastics, of course, it's a necessary condition of the monastic life. And so celibacy is laid down by the Buddha because celibacy gives a certain freedom. It helps to cut down this tendency of craving, always to be seeking enjoyment, sexual enjoyment through the senses. When one takes the precept of celibacy, then it means one has to control the senses. Control one's mind, control one's thinking. And though it's a difficult principle to observe, as one lives the celibate life, one finds that it brings inner happiness, inner freedom, inner purity. But the Buddha doesn't teach that one should enter upon the life of celibacy in a kind of radical or drastic way, but one should approach it gradually. First, the lay people, one should observe 5 precepts, taking the 3rd precept, to prepare oneself for the celibate life. From time to time, one should observe the 8 precepts, taking the 3rd precept as the precept to be celibate, at least for a temporary period. But those who feel a calling or a sense of attraction to the monastic life don't have to approach gradually, but whenever they feel that attraction, that pull becomes strong enough, then they can seek the going forth into homelessness. A Okay, celibacy is one meaning of brahmacharya. But in the text, the word brahmacharya has another meaning, a wider meaning. In this wider meaning, brahmacharya means the entire holy life, the entire spiritual life. And so the Buddha says, in some suttas, in the Samyutta Nikaya, what is the holy life? It is this noble eightfold path. So in this way, the eightfold path is the brahmacharya, the spiritual life. And already in the eightfold path, already we've pretty much covered the ethical side. So what is especially being emphasized in this next to the last verse of the Mandala Sutta as the essence of the holy life, now building upon austerity, leading to realization, what is being emphasized is, as I would understand it, right effort and right mindfulness leading to right concentration and right contemplation, a contemplation that will bring insight. Okay, and so building upon this right effort and right mindfulness, one develops right concentration. When the mind is rightly concentrated, one contemplates the phenomena of mind and body arising and passing away. And as one enters upon this knowledge, this insight knowledge of arising and passing away, at that point one could say one has truly entered the plane of exertion. The plane of exertion refers especially to this stage when all of the factors of intense practice are working together to generate the heat of exertion, the heat of intense effort. And as this heat of exertion, this heat of effort builds up and gathers momentum, at a certain point it will culminate, it will reach its climax in a breakthrough to the unconditioned element, the realization, momentary realization, or true insight into the Four Noble Truths. This is the third blessing in this verse, the seeing of the Noble Truths. And that will bring the movement to the plane of vision, where the disciple now who has reached the high point in the development of insight now sees the unconditioned reality, the deathless element, nirvana. And by seeing nirvana, all Four Noble Truths are seen simultaneously. One sees the Noble Truth of suffering clearly, distinctly. One sees that craving is truly the cause of suffering, clearly, distinctly. One sees that nirvana is truly the end of suffering. And one sees clearly this Noble Eightfold Path is truly the way to the end of suffering. And so one sees these Four Noble Truths momentarily. Just all of the clouds of ignorance are scattered. Just like on a cloudy night, suddenly a wind blows and the clouds are blown away, and one can see the full moon. But then the wind blows again, the clouds come back, the moon is covered up again. But one has seen the moon, one knows the moon is there, one has no doubt that it's a full moon night. And so, this breakthrough to the realization or seeing of the Noble Truths, that is the plane of vision. And when one makes that breakthrough, one becomes a stream enterer, one who has reached the stream of the Dhamma and can never fall back again. But that attainment of the first stage of liberation, stream entry, is not yet the end. One has to go on cultivating the practice to reach the full realization of nirvana. And so from the plane of vision, one goes to the plane of cultivation, where one has to go on again practicing right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, right contemplation, again and again. And as one does so, one goes through the second and third and fourth stages of realization. And the fourth stage, all the defilements are eliminated. And we can call that stage the realization of nirvana. So here, I don't want to go into theoretical explanations of nirvana, but the practical, meaningful explanation, what is nirvana? The blowing out, the extinction of all the defilements of the mind. The blowing out or going out of greed, hatred, and ignorance. And so, when one cultivates the path, again and again, one is seeing the Noble Truths more and more clearly, until when they are most clearly seen, all the defilements are extinguished, and one achieves the realization of nirvana. And that marks, in verse 10, that is the culmination in the practice of the world transcending Dharma. But the Mandala Sutta doesn't end with that attainment. But there's one more verse describing four more blessings. This is verse 11.
Uttasa loka dhamme Chitam yasana kantati Asaukam virajam kemam Ekam mangalamuttamam.
According to our translator, it says, if one's mind is sorrowless, stainless, and secure in Nibbana, and is not disturbed when affected by worldly vicissitudes, this is the most auspicious performance. All the translation, I'd say, is good, except I would have put it according to the sequence of the Pali. I would say, one whose mind is not disturbed when affected by worldly vicissitudes, sorrowless, stainless, and secure, this is the most auspicious performance. Okay, I would just say that the theme of this verse, I call the theme fulfillment, and describe this as embodying the world transcending Dhamma in the world. That is, in verse 10, we've reached the completion in the way upwards. We've gone all the ways from the beginning. We've now come to the top of the world transcending Dhamma with the realization of Nirvana. Verse 11 shows us how one brings that world transcending Dhamma in the world, how one embodies that liberated mind in the world. And so one whose mind is unshaken by changing worldly conditions. The texts speak of four pairs of worldly opposites, changing opposites. There is gain and loss, fame and obscurity, praise and blame, pleasure and pain. The Buddha says these are the four pairs of worldly opposites that keep the world turning around in circles, keep the world in bondage. And ordinary people with the minds undeveloped are always attracted to gain, to wealth, to fame, to praise, to pleasure. And when they get them, they become attached to them. And when they meet with loss or poverty, when they meet with dishonor or obscurity, when we're blamed and criticized, when we experience pain, then we become upset and miserable. And so our minds are like seesaws going up and down, up and down. Our minds are shaking. Like we're shaken by worldly conditions. But one whose mind has fully realized the world transcending Dhamma, Nirvana, their mind is unshaken by worldly conditions. No attachment to gain, honor, fame, praise, pleasure. And when they meet with loss, obscurity, blame, pain, the mind is not disturbed. They still experience physical pain, sometimes terrible physical pain, but the mind remains calm, unshaken. Okay, and so the mind is sorrowless, never experiences any sorrow, grief, misery, worry, anxiety, distress. All of that is finished. The mind is stainless, literally free from dust. There are many, many defilements. All of those defilements have been eliminated completely. The Buddha says that all of these defilements spring up from the deep underlying tendencies of defilements. But for the arahant, the liberated one, those defilements have been cut off right at the level of the underlying tendencies. So the mind is free from even the subtlest little dust-like tendencies for the defilements. And the mind completely free from defilements, from the dust, is kaimani, secure. The mind is secure because it will never come back to any realm of conditioned existence. It's now fully liberated. Okay, so that brings to conclusion, what brings to an end, is verse 11 on fulfillment. And then, to conclude the sutta, the Buddha speaks one final verse. which again I'll recite in Pali.
Eta desani katvana sabata mukarachita sabata sotinga chantitam te sammangalamukkamam.
Okay. I would translate a little differently again.
Those who act thus are everywhere unconquered. They attain happiness everywhere. For them are those who receive the greatest blessing. Okay, so this in a way just sums up the whole sutta. So those who act thus, who have fulfilled all of these stages spoken of in the Mangala Sutta, beginning with the orientation, not to associate with the foolish, to associate with the wise, establish secure foundations, undergo the preparations, and then some may lead a virtuous life in the world, others may go directly into the life of renunciation, but then they all have to observe personal ethics, develop a spiritual life, enter the ascent towards realization, and come to fulfillment. Those who fulfill all of these stages, they achieve victory everywhere, and they attain security everywhere. And so the Buddha says, they achieve the greatest blessing. And so you can see how comprehensive this one sutta is, just 12 verses, but it covers all aspects of life, from the most elementary stages to the culmination of the spiritual life. Okay, I thank you all for your attention and for listening, and may the blessings of the Noble Triple Chan be with you all. Okay, we conclude by sharing the merits. Okay, we'll do these verses, then take the questions and answers.
Akasata ca bhumata devanaga mahiddhika panyanta nanumodhita chiram rakantu sasanam. Akasata ca bhumata devanagamahiddhika panyanta nanumodhita chiram rakantu desanam. Akasata ca bhumata devanagamahiddhika panyanta nanumodhita chiram rakantu mantram. Etagata chamhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabhe devamadantu sabha sampati siddhya. Etagata chamhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabhe bhuta namadam tu sabha sampati siddhya. Etagata chamhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabhe sat.
Okay, we take questions now, just for a few, like 10 minutes of questions. People always sit in the back corner. Well, we do have a little group up here in the front also. But please feel welcome to ask any questions.
No one will ask questions. I have a question. When you were explaining going from the plane of exertion to the plane of vision, you talked about that in the plane of exertion, if one practices on the basis of right effort and right mindfulness, one reaches right concentration. And through right contemplation, one reaches insight. And then you said something like, something about one begins to see the Four Noble Truths. Are you saying that one sees Four Noble Truths one after another at this stage, and when one reaches the plane of vision, one sees Four Noble Truths momentarily all at once?
In the plane of exertion, one doesn't really see the Four Noble Truths, but one is starting to see more and more clearly the three characteristics: impermanence, dukkha, suffering, and selflessness or non-self. In a sense, these come under the first noble truth, so we could say that one is starting to see the first noble truth, and to some extent one is starting to see in one's experience the second noble truth. One could see through reflection how craving causes suffering, how when one becomes attached or things, it causes more dukkha to arise in the mind. That one could see through direct experience. But the actual penetration of the Four Noble Truths is what takes place at the plane of vision. At that point, one actually breaks through to the third noble truth, to the unconditioned, to nirvana. And it is only when one sees nirvana that one truly sees altogether the four noble truths. One sees how they all fit together into one whole. Because now, when one sees nirvana as the cessation of dukkha, the cessation of suffering, from that standpoint, one can look back and see that anything within the five aggregates, anything conditioned, dependently originated, is unsatisfactory, is in some way imperfect. So it's dukkha, suffering. And one has seen, by seeing nirvana, one understands how it is through craving that dukkha originates. Not only psychologically, how attachment brings suffering in the mind, but one understands directly how this craving is what brings renewed existence from one life to the next. One is seeing nirvana, directly, and so one is now seeing the third noble truth. And one now sees and understands how this Noble Eightfold Path that one has practiced is truly the way to the cessation of suffering. Because one has practiced it and seen how it brings the realization of that state, which is the cessation of suffering.
So, if we don't get too technical about this, one really begins to see the Four Noble Truths in a gradual sense. Because one, for example, one has to practice the Noble Eightfold Path in order to complete the plane of exertion.
Yeah.
Right. So, and then one has to be able to see impermanence through the understanding the impermanence of rising and
yeah.
passing away of mind and the body.
Yeah.
So one is gradually seeing the Four Noble Truths. So what we're when we say that one sees Four Noble Truths momentarily all at once, we're saying that the completion of the Four Noble Truths.
Yeah, yeah. One would say in the plane of exertion, one is seeing harshly, to some extent, the truth of dukkha. One sees, from one angle, the second noble truth, how craving originates suffering in the psychological sense. In the psychological sense, one can have a kind of inferential understanding of the third noble truth. One sees how, or experiences how, as one's attachment loosens up, as one lets go, one is becoming more and more free from dukkha, one is not getting entangled in anxiety, worry, distress in one's mind. And one has some experience of how practicing this path factor is bringing the reduction of dukkha. But it's not yet a real definitive seeing of the Noble Truth. That is only what that takes place only at the third stage, the plane of seeing. Any additional questions?
What percentage of lay followers get to that stage of stream entry?
I don't think it's so rare. Don't think it's so difficult. In the Buddha's time, many, many would reach the stage of stream entry. And that's only through intensive practice. Of course, people who would have reached without intensive practice would have had very sharp faculties from previous lives. And so when they hear the Buddha or some advanced monastic person give a discourse, then their faculties, developed faculties, suddenly come up, and then they can make the breakthrough. But I think nowadays there are people who practice, lay people, quite earnestly, and do achieve the stages of stream entry, once return. I've heard some cases of lay people who are said to have reached the stage of non-return. So it's possible, it's not all that. In fact, I've heard it said by not a few meditation masters, by several meditation masters, that the best practitioners, not monks, not nuns, not lay men, but laymen. Yes.
Why?
I didn't hear the answer to the thing. Because I didn't hear it from them directly, but I've heard it through so-and-so told, well, a person told me that such and such meditation masters has said that the best, and these are meditation masters who have taught many pupils, have said, my best practitioners are women, are lay women. So I would just have to surmise an answer. And this is in Asia, where women really do, say, the full drudge, have gone through the difficulties of household life, you know, bringing up families with, it's not where they have birth control, so they could have one child, two children, no children, but they might have had to bring up five, six children. So they've gone through all the difficulties of lay life, and so they have a real clear sense of dukkha. And so when they practice, it's done with full earnestness. And also what I'm told is that monks, especially, I've heard this again through the grapevine that the meditation master say, that some of his worst practitioners are learned, scholarly trained monks. Because when they practice, they're always trying to relate their practice to theoretical models that they've learned. Whereas the lay women, not concerned with theoretical models, not trying to, you know, see whether their experience corresponds to this theory, this commentary, that commentary, but they just go into it, whatever the master tells them to do, they do it. And also maybe because women are able to connect in a way more directly with experience than men who tend to use conceptual schemes to interpret experience. Ooh, this is being recorded.